This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Friday, April 12, 2024. I'm Caleb Brown. Over at least the last two decades, countries that perform well in terms of human freedom are much more prosperous. That shouldn't be surprising, but the strength of that relationship should inform economic and development policy. Cato Institute adjunct John Early has dug a little deeper into the data. We spoke last month in Dallas.
The Cato Institute is the partner with the Fraser Institute in producing the Human Freedom Index that I know Ian Vasquez spends a lot of time on to make sure all the numbers are right. And one of the most profound things that I've seen is the degree to which freedom and prosperity go together. How should we understand that relationship?
It's actually a relationship that's kind of been noted throughout history, going all the way back to Plato. You know, Adam Smith and Milton Friedman and Friedrich Hayek have all advocated for and shown how freedom generates more prosperity. And this index gives us a chance now to test that mathematically. Does the greater level of freedom within the indexes of freedom, there actually are 82 different components that go into it. Does the greater freedom there translate into greater prosperity? And the research that I've done shows that A, that's true, B, it's true very strongly, and thirdly, that's very important. That's good news.
So how do we understand that relationship in, you know, more granular detail? How do we measure that relationship?
We did some mathematics, some econometrics, and we looked at the measure of prosperity as measured by the GDP, or gross domestic product, per working person in the economy across nearly 100 different countries for which we had, you know, adequate data. And it showed that over the last period of time from the year 2000 to 2019, the countries that scored very well on certain key components of that index also prospered in terms of increasing the wealth and the income and the prosperity of the people in the country. And we found specifically that we could explain about two-thirds of the variation in the amount of prosperity among these nations by five specific things. One is the measure of freedom as part of the Human Freedom Index of having a system that assures legal and property rights. That was the strongest one in the contribution. The second one, again, a component of the Human Freedom Index, is providing safety and security. So you have legal and property rights, you have safety and security. The third was the freedom to trade internationally. And again, that's part of that index. The index also measures the tax burden, which contributes. And then we added another component, which is not part of the Freedom Index, but the capital formation rate in a country. And as I said, those five things explain about two-thirds of the variation in prosperity. Now, what's important in part of this is that if you then take the 90-some-odd countries that were in the data set and you looked at the most prosperous and the least prosperous, those relationships still held. In other words, for those that are the most prosperous countries, they could improve their prosperity by improving their freedom. They've got pretty good freedom, but they can do better. For those at the bottom, they have very lousy freedom, but improving that freedom is going to help their prosperity. And we tested this also then with some alternative tests, such as, well, some countries are what are called geographically advantaged, and there are a series of indexes on the geographical advantage that people have, like whether they have coastal access, whether or not they have isolated populations back in the center of the country, whether they're subject to tropical diseases. And once you've adjusted for freedom or accounted for freedom, those no longer have any impact. Part of that's probably due to the technology changes that have made those things less important. But those no longer explain any of the difference.
So 100 years ago, that might have made a much more significant
difference. As it turned out, it was about 20 years ago.
Is that right?
Yeah, 20 to 40 years ago. The studies that were done back then, that seemed to make a difference. But we have two things going for us now. We have A, we've got the improvement the technology has helped with. We've also got better measures of freedom. that are more comprehensive than they had back then. For example, safety and security is a piece that was not in the indexes that were used for those earlier studies.
In terms of driving policy, it would seem to give every country on Earth pretty clear marching orders about how to conduct their affairs.
Yes. And some of the details, there may be some murkiness on, but the strategy is very clear. And in fact, Caleb, that actually ties into one of the things that's helped stimulate having this discussion, the paper in the first place. There's a set of principles or guiding principles, if you would, called the American consensus. Now, it wasn't necessarily entirely a consensus, and it was never anything formal, but it just kind of grew up as a list of about 8 things that countries should do in order to improve their economic status. And it should therefore guide, for example, the foreign aid policy of richer countries as they address those needs of less wealthy, and also should guide international organizations. And those items were, you know, such things as safeguarding property rights, having small deficits, having a lowered marginal tax rate, and freer international trade. Well, that has been kind of the guiding principle, and there have been debates around it, and it's not anything terribly formal, but it's been observed generally. But all of a sudden, some of the international agencies started departing from that. And so at the, I think it was the 2020 G7 meeting, they appointed a economic resilience panel of a bunch of bureaucrats to go off, and they developed what was called the new economic paradigm. It's since become known as the Cornwall Consensus, because that's where they went. They went off to Cornwall to develop it. Now, it's very different in that it's not reflecting a consensus of practice. It was actually developed by people who went to school to learn how to be government bureaucrats. So what did they come up with? Well, a list of things for government bureaucrats to do, such as, instead of safeguarding property rights, well, let's take free trade. They do have free trade in there, or freer trade, which is good. But in the same paragraph, they mention that they need to revise the trade guidelines with respect to intellectual property, especially with respect to pharmaceuticals, because they don't want pharmaceutical companies being able to sell their products freely. They want government bureaucrats to sell their products for them. But that's the one place where they are sort of right, but every place else they're wrong. For example, they want more government investment in climate modification. They want to increase regulation in lots of different ways. For example, to recognize, with respect to intellectual capital, the collective value creation. It's just a more wordy bureaucratic restatement of Obama's statement if they didn't make that. In other words, if something is developed, a new product, a new service, somebody does better, someone makes some money, that belongs to the collective. They also looked at supply chains. And they said, well, supply chains, let me quote this, should be managed collectively at the political level in order to optimize supply chains. Of course, this was written right at the height of the effect of COVID. And they said, government has to do something. Well, it sorted out pretty well without government, partly because government didn't know what it was doing. And our Secretary of Transportation was missing in action. Generally, government should intervene to collectively solve X, Y, and Z of several different things. In any case, so if you take the American consensus and map it against the variables we found to be significant for assuring prosperity, you will find that most of the items in the American consensus are found in the freedom indexes that we used in the analysis. Now, some of the things are missing from the American that could be strengthened that we found that aren't there. But the converse is everything in the American consensus is pretty much reflected in the freedom elements that we found that create prosperity. Now, if you do this with respect to the Cornwall or New Economic Consensus, you'll find that all of them stand in 180 degrees contradiction to what we found. Because instead of free markets determining prosperity with their freedom to act, they are looking for bureaucrats to tell people what to do.
It sounds like a jobs program, this Cornwall consensus.
Oh, well, that's what it is, yeah.
Or a framework for a future jobs mm-hmm. program. And so, you know, comparing bureaucrats, you know, international bureaucrats and their views on what role they can play, which by excluding a lot of the elements of this American consensus, they seem to think that their role to play is actually the most important role that can be played. It strikes me that there isn't really any room for surprise?
Well, it may depend on what you mean by surprise.
Well, I mean,
because they're going to be surprised when they go off and do this, and 10 years from now, things are worse if they do it. Hopefully, they don't get the chance.
Well, it's like the great fictional chef Auguste Gusteau said, essentially, a great chef can come from anywhere, which is a great idea can come from anywhere. And once you've protected all of these elements for individuals to make the best of their individual situations, you, in a sense, are maximizing the ability of having these great ideas.
Hayek and others have pointed out, there's nobody smart enough to be a central planner. But most of these require, for example, this, quote, solution to the supply chain by collective political level decision tells us that there's nobody that's smart enough to fix that because the economy is constantly changing and the people who are sitting there at the nexus of the changing in supply and demand and the delays in shipment and the breakthroughs in technology can react to those and optimize their welfare, the welfare of their customers, the welfare, therefore, of whole societies. Whereas some bureaucrats sitting in an office, their data doesn't arrive fast enough even for them to make those decisions because they're not sitting at the nexus of the action. And that's straying to some degree off of the details of this specific paper, but that's the implication. We've seen that already. We've been told this before, and now we've got statistical proof of it.
John Early is an adjunct scholar at the Cato Institute. Subscribe to and rate the Cato Daily Podcast wherever you please. And thank you for listening.